Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. If you'd like to be on the program, we have lines open for you right now, and you can call if you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity, and you would like to bring that up here on the program for our audience and myself. Also, if you have a difference of opinion from me on anything that you've heard me say, feel free to call and balance comment on that matter. And we have all our lines open right now, so you can call at 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. And I want to make one announcement while we await your calls, and that is that tomorrow night, Saturday night, is the monthly gathering we have in Santa Cruz in a home each month. It's at 7 o'clock Saturday evening. If you are a listener who would like to get to know other listeners to the program in the area or would like to simply come and talk about biblical issues that you have questions about, that's what it is. It's an open discussion. It's pretty much like this radio program. So we get a bunch of our friends, people who are listeners to the program, in the room, and we have an open discussion for a few hours. That happens once a month in Santa Cruz. It's happening tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. If you'd like directions to that meeting, you can call Mike or Brenda, and they'll give you directions. The number to call is area code 831-475-8301. That's 831-475-8301. And again, if you'd like to be on the program today, the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. We're going to talk, first of all, to Bob, calling from Happy Valley, Oregon today. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hello, sir. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I've got a quick question, and then I'm just going to hang up. I come from a Pentecostal-type background, attending the Assemblies of God for lots and lots and lots of years. I've got a question about the Church of Christ. Could you explain to me a little bit about that? I've got some folks that are wanting me to talk to some folks, and I'm not really too sure about that whole thing. I imagine there's nothing wrong with it. Then again, I just don't know. And you know a little bit about my background, so if I could just hang up and you could talk a little bit about that and give me a little bit of input on that, that would really help me out.
Okay, Bob. Thanks for your call.
Thanks, man.
Okay. Well, first of all, the Church of Christ is going to be very different from Pentecostal because they don't believe in the continuation of the gifts of the Holy Spirit after the apostolic age. So that's one big difference. If you've been baptized in the Holy Spirit and you speak with tongues, they will disagree with that. They won't believe it's legitimate. And depending on who, you know, what kind of people you're with, they might even think it's of the devil because they just don't believe in that being from God today. Now, Church of Christ are not all the same. The Church of Christ is something of a denomination, though they would say they're not a denomination. They want to simply be a simple, primitive Christian assembly. What they stand for, generally speaking, that would be different from what many other evangelicals would stand for, would be, they would believe that water baptism is essential for salvation, whereas many evangelicals would believe that it's not essential, but they do. And depending on which group you would attend, there are instrumental and there are non-instrumental Church of Christ. The non-instrumental Church of Christ do not believe in using musical instruments. And so any singing they would do would be a cappella, and they would be against musical instruments, which I'm sure would be very different from the Pentecostal background you've got. Now, not all Church of Christ have that view about musical instruments. As I say, there are instrumental Church of Christ and there's non-instrumental Church of Christ. And the non-instrumental ones would be the ones, of course, opposed to using musical instruments. So I don't know which group you're connecting with through your friends. The main thing that you would find different would be the insistence that a person who's not baptized is not saved. And also, of course, from a difference from your Pentecostal background, they would not believe that any gifts of the Holy Spirit, like speaking in tongues, are valid today. And again, they might even think that it's from the devil. Some would think that and some might not. So those would be the main differences I would think you'd encounter with the Church of Christ. They are, theologically speaking, Church of Christ, I believe, are not Calvinistic, which is a positive thing, I believe. And also, they are not dispensational, which I think is a positive thing. Now, your Pentecostal background probably is dispensational. And that would, I'm talking primarily about views of end times prophecy. The Pentecostals usually are dispensational in their end times views. Church of Christ, I believe, is amillennial. So they'd be one of the rare groups that is amillennial and not Calvinistic, because most amillennial groups are Calvinistic. Amillennialism and Calvinism are usually considered to go together as parts of Reformed theology. The Church of Christ is not Calvinistic. Anyway, those would be some of the things that, without knowing any more specific questions from you, the things that would be immediately off the top of my head, things you would wish to know. Now, if you wonder whether I think they're a good church, that would depend. I've certainly known some Church of Christ men who were wonderful Christians, and I've never been a member of a Church of Christ assembly. But I do know that some people in the Church of Christ are a little bit hard-nosed about the distinctives, about the baptism issue, and also if they're non-instrumental, they might even be hard-nosed about that issue. In all likelihood, you know, if the people that you know who are in the Church of Christ are gracious people, you won't find too much of an issue there. And since you have been baptized, I assume, with water, that you shouldn't come into any problems about that, I would hope. Anyway, those would be the few things I would say just off the top of my head about that, Bob, and I hope that may give you some assistance in knowing how to relate with them. Let's talk to Jim from Salinas, California next. And if you'd like to be on the program, we have lines open at 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. And Jim, welcome to the Narrow Path. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, Steve, I don't know. I'm getting a little older, but I think you might have heard your caller wrong. I thought I heard him ask about the Church of God and not the Church of Christ.
I thought he said the Church of Christ.
Well, he might have, but I could be wrong, but I thought I could almost swear that I thought I heard him say Church of God. Now, I might be wrong.
Well, if he had said Church of God, and if that's what I had heard him say, I would have asked him further.
Thing.
Yeah, I would ask him whether he's talking about the Church of God Cleveland, Tennessee, or the Church of God Anderson, Indiana. Because those are different from each other.
I didn't realize there was a different. I knew about one of the Church of God, which is almost fundamental Pentecostal, except for one more church of the altar, which is sanctification.
Yeah, that would be. I believe that'd be the Church of God of Cleveland, Tennessee. They are Pentecostal.
Yeah.
Whereas the Church of God of Anderson, Indiana, are much more like the Church of Christ in their theology, as I understand.
Right.
Not entirely, perhaps, but. Yeah, usually if someone asks me about the Church of God, the first thing that I want to ask is which one of these churches of God are you interested in? And I think that's why I think he said Church of Christ, because it never occurred to me to ask that further clarification.
Of course, this is a recorded program, so we'll know, but I could be wrong. I mean, but, you know, because like I say, sometimes I'm getting a little older and I don't hear things quite like I used to. But,
well, if you wait up.
I did hear him say Church of God.
Yeah, if you wait up till 11 o'clock at night and listen to the program again, then you'll know, and so will I, if I'm awake.
Most of the time I don't, unless I miss the program.
Oh, confession time.
Anyway, I didn't have any other comment but that, and I hope I'm wrong, because you gave a good explanation of the Church of Christ. Which, you know, somebody might have wondered about it anyway. But.
Well, if Bob did want to know about the Church of God, he can call back, because he heard my answer, and he can say, hey, that was the wrong church you were talking about.
Okay, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, but I thought I heard Church of God.
It's okay.
Okay, brother. God bless you.
God bless you, Jim. Good talking
to you.
Okay, bye now. All right, we have open lines for you now on this program. If you'd like to be on, you're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can call me here with questions if you have questions about the Bible or Christianity, or with disagreements if you have those. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. 90. And I have a question that was emailed to me today from Gunther. And he says he's reading my articles at my website about divorce and remarriage. And if you don't know that, I have a three-part series that's made into one lengthy article. These were three articles that I had published in a magazine some years ago on divorce and remarriage. And he had some follow-up questions on that. And I may get around to those, I mean, between calls. Looks like we're going to have some calls to take right now. And I really like to go to the callers first before I take the email questions. But anyway, Gunther had some follow-up on this, on my articles on divorce and remarriage. But we'll put that aside for the moment until we can deal with some of these calls that are now filling our lines up. I don't have any names in front of me, though, so my call screen suddenly got swamped. All the lines lit up, and he hasn't had time to type in any names for me, so I don't know who's on those lines. So I will take the time. Maybe I should answer Gunther's question, although it's not, let's take Gunther's question right now. He says, if I understand it correctly, you are saying, he means in my articles about divorce and remarriage, that a person that has been divorced for unbiblical reasons before he became a Christian has the moral obligation to seek remarriage to the former spouse. Does this apply also to the case where the former spouse is still an unbeliever? Would the believer not be prohibited to marry an unbeliever? Now, let me clarify what this question is arising from. I believe, based on what Jesus said, that if a man divorces his wife for any cause other than fornication and marries another, he commits adultery and causes her to commit adultery when she remarries also. That Jesus is saying that the reason they can't remarry is because they're still married to each other. Now, of course, in the scenario Jesus gave, they got a divorce. That is, they got a legal divorce. But Jesus said if they got a legal divorce for any reason other than fornication, it's not a legitimate divorce. And if it's not a legitimate divorce, they're still married to each other. That's basically what you'd have to conclude. If two people made vows before God to be faithful and true to each other for their whole life, and then one of them has decided to get the state to declare them to be divorced, but Jesus says, but you don't have grounds, so the state has no right to say you're divorced. The state has no right to declare an end to your marriage vows because there's no grounds for it. Well, then, whatever the state may say, you're still married. And that's what Jesus is saying, because otherwise he couldn't say that if you remarry, you're committing adultery. You see, he might oppose second marriages on some other grounds, but it couldn't be that it was adultery unless the marriage is still in force, the first marriage. Because adultery specifically means violating an existing marriage covenant. So if getting married a second time is adultery, that means the first marriage is being violated. It means the first marriage is still in force, or else it wouldn't be adultery, it would be something else. So what Jesus is saying is there are grounds for divorce, namely fornication on the part of your partner. But without those grounds, there aren't grounds for divorce. And therefore, even if the state would grant you a divorce, the state really doesn't have the competence to do it because God doesn't grant it. Now, the question that this man is writing to me about is, what if a man has gotten a divorce before he was a Christian, and now he's a Christian, and his former wife is also still not a Christian? Does he have the obligation to go back to her? Well, of course. I mean, if they're not legitimately divorced, they're married. Married people should stay together, even if one has become a Christian. Paul made that very clear in 1 Corinthians 7. If a believer is married to an unbeliever, the believer is not supposed to leave. The believer is supposed to stay in the marriage as long as the unbeliever will permit it. I'd rather have more quiet here. So anyway, the couple is still married in that case. And the fact that one has gotten saved and the other has not really changed that status. What we have to understand, and what I think Christians maybe are being forced to understand more now than they used to, is that it's not the state that tells if you're married or divorced. It's God. God is the one who created marriage. God is the one whose approval makes a marriage valid. And only God can determine when a marriage is really validly over. The state has no competence in these areas. The state doesn't know who can be married and who can't be married. Obviously, many states are now marrying same-sex couples. They obviously don't know what marriage is. So I don't know why any Christians would trust the state in this matter. If the state says you're married, well, maybe you are, maybe you're not. The state will marry two people who aren't really free to marry in God's sight. For example, if a man divorces his wife for no good reason and wants to marry a second woman, the state will give him a marriage license. Jesus says that's not marriage, that's adultery. There's a world of difference between marriage and adultery. The state can say it's marriage all they want to, but they can't overrule God. It's still adultery if God says it's adultery. Likewise, the state has no power to break up a marriage because God's the one who decides when that can be done. So Christians really, I think, are living at a time where more and more people who get married are going to have to do it as something inside the church. This opinion about it's going to have to be absolutely irrelevant. It already is. I mean, like I said, the state is now marrying same-sex couples. It divorces people who have no grounds for divorce. It remarries people who have no legitimacy to remarry. The state has it's out of control. I mean, the state has just totally lost touch with reality a long time ago. So the state's opinion, frankly, never did matter very much, but it's very obvious now that it truly doesn't matter. It's what God thinks that matters. I think that marriages in the near future that Christians enter into are going to have to be matters done where it's just the church that they attend is recognizing, witnessing their vows, holding their feet to the fire to keep their vows and so forth. And, you know, whether they get a marriage license from the state or not is going to be, as far as I'm concerned, a non-issue. It never was an issue in the Bible. There's no state licensing a marriage in the Bible. God is the one who created marriage, and it's a matter for the Christian community and the families of the people involved to make decisions about. Okay, let's talk to Michael from Cutler, California. Hi, Michael. I don't know where Cutler is.
Oh, it's in the outskirts of Fresno.
Oh, okay. Good to hear from you.
I was just listening to the last caller asking about the Church of Christ, and I had a question on a different denomination. If you could give me a synopsis of the Jehovah's Witness Church, and also specifically their theology on the year 1914. And the second part of my question is, do they have any branches or different denominations within that same church? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Michael, sure. Well, the Jehovah's Witnesses, I don't believe they do have any branches because their boast is that they are all unified. In fact, that's one thing that they look to prove that they're the true church, because Jesus prayed that his people would be one. And the Jehovah's Witnesses all agree with each other and are all one. They don't have denominations. Of course, that's easy to maintain. As soon as someone disagrees, they get kicked out. You know, any organization could have complete unity if you've got tyranny. You know, Hitler had almost complete unity in his country, too. I mean, there was an underground, but he, you know, if they were hunted down, they'd be gotten rid of. There's one way to maintain unity in a church, and that's to kick everybody out who doesn't agree with whoever leads. And that's what the Jehovah's Witnesses have always done. Jehovah's Witnesses are a movement that started in the late 1800s, or actually just the mid 1800s. And it was started by a guy named Charles Taze Russell, who just began a Bible study, really, and had a group of people studying with him, and they were called the Millennial Dawn Bible students or something like that. I forget their original name, but he had views different than those of mainstream Christianity. He believed, for example, in what we call Arianism. He didn't believe Jesus is God. He didn't believe the Holy Spirit is God. He had some convictions about certain practices that differed from other denominations. He was believed in total pacifism. He believed that it was wrong to get blood transfusions. He believed it was wrong to salute the flag and so forth. And these are some things that were in their outward behavior that caused certain other people to marginalize them. But most people who had theological concerns about orthodoxy were more concerned about their views concerning the Trinity, because they didn't believe in the Trinity, and they still don't, of course. Now, you asked about their views of about 1914. Prior to 1914, the Watchtower Society, which is the organization that owns the Jehovah's Witness movement, the Watchtower Society made many predictions in print that the second coming of Christ would occur in 1914. These predictions are not publicized by the Watchtower Society anymore, of course, but they have been preserved by critics of Jehovah's Witnesses, and you can find the quotes in certain anti-Jehovah's Witness literature. And these were published in Watchtower Magazine and Awake Magazine, which are the two publications of the organization. And as a result, the Jehovah's Witnesses were anticipating Christ to come in 1914. Well, you may have noticed he didn't come in 1914, and so they had to modify something. Now, I don't remember exactly how they explain it now. They do believe that Jesus moved from, I think, his seat at the right hand of God to someplace closer to here, if I'm not mistaken. And by the way, any Jehovah's Witnesses listening to me are certainly welcome to call and correct me about this, because I don't claim to be an expert about this. I get their views mixed up a little bit with those of Ellen G. White, who started the Seventh-day Adventists and who also predicted the second coming of Christ in the early days of the 20th century. And in both movements, Jesus, of course, didn't come back, but the Seventh-day Adventists modified their view to say, well, he went, at that time he went into the Holy of Holies or something like that, and he's doing something different than what he was doing before that. The Jehovah's Witnesses also had something. I don't remember the details. It's been quite a few years since I studied their view on this. But there's some change they say that Jesus made in 1914, but that was just to cover themselves, because they were anticipating the end of the world. They were anticipating the actual visible coming of Christ in 1914. It was after that prediction failed to materialize that they came up with something to cover their backsides about that. And as far as I'm concerned, the organization has no credibility. For one thing, they weren't even honest enough to say they were wrong. You know, if someone predicts that Jesus is coming back a certain date and he doesn't, the honest thing to do would say, well, you know, I was really wrong about that. But they wouldn't do that. Instead, they said, no, we were right. We just you just misunderstood us. And when people have to do that, you know, they're just a pack of liars and you don't have any reason to trust them. I'm not saying that all Jehovah's Witnesses are liars, not at all. I think most Jehovah's Witnesses are innocent enough, but the organization's run by liars, obviously. And one of the things that indicates that, too, is they had to make their own translation of the Bible, because the real Bible contradicted their theology on too many points. And so they came up with their own translation called the New World Translation, where they changed what the Bible said on a lot of things in order to make it agree more with what they teach. Once again, another dishonest move on the part of their leadership. I guess the average Jehovah's Witness on the street may not know how dishonest the Watchtower Society has been throughout history. Back in the early days of their movement, the Watchtower Society actually was selling what they called miracle wheat, which they made almost magical claims about how productive this wheat would be if you bought it from them. I don't know why they said it, what it was that made it so good, but it turned out to be just ordinary wheat, and they got sued for that, and again, they did not admit that they were wrong. This is the problem with an organization. When they're wrong again and again and again, and they won't admit it, the best thing you can do is just stay as far from them as you can. Now, of course, a lot of people would stay far from them, away from them, because of their views on the Trinity or on something else. As far as I'm concerned, you should just stay away from them because they're dishonest. That's a dishonest organization. Not the people who come to your door. They probably are not dishonest, but their leaders are, and their organization, which they think is the true organization of Christ on the earth. And obviously, any true organization of Christ on the earth could not be so dishonest. So that would be my thoughts about the Jehovah's Witnesses movement. We're going to talk next to Yusef Lateef in Eugene, Oregon. And Yusef Lateef, hello. How are you?
Hello, brother. I'm doing fine. How are you?
Getting better.
Thank you, Lord. Let me see something. I had a question about the book of Jude. I figured that you might have, researched this out and stuff like that. As I understand, Jude makes some mention of some things that Enoch came from Enoch. And I guess I was wondering, where did he get this information from? I mean, is there some passages in the Bible that I am unknowing of or is in relation to this?
No, he's quoting from a book called The Book of Enoch. First Enoch. There's four books of Enoch, and he's quoting from First Enoch. Now, the problem is that these books of Enoch were not written by Enoch.
Uh-huh.
They were written thousands of years after the time of Enoch. But the author of those books put the name Enoch on there because that was something that people were doing a lot in the time between the two testaments. Enoch uh-huh. was probably written about 200 years before Christ. Around that time, there were a lot of Jewish books being written that were not inspired. They were just written by Jewish people and read as popular literature. And each of them claimed to be by somebody famous from the past. You know, books that claim to be written by the patriarchs or written by Baruch, Jeremiah's scribe, or, you know, written by any number of famous people from the Old Testament were written a great number. And there were these four books of Enoch, of which the first one contains the quote that Jude uses. Now, the biggest problem is that Jude sounds like he's quoting it as if it were really Enoch who said it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he said Enoch, the seventh from Adam, spoke of these men. And then he quotes this passage. So it sounds like Jude is affirming that these words were the words of Enoch, the seventh from Adam. But that may not be the necessary way to understand it, because the author of the book of Enoch introduces himself at the beginning of the book as Enoch, the seventh from Adam, those very words.
Uh-huh.
And therefore Jude, although he's not quoting the real man, Enoch, he's quoting a book by a man who calls himself Enoch, the seventh from Adam. Now, the real author is anonymous. And so, you know, Jude might be saying, you know, this man who calls himself Enoch, the seventh from Adam, wrote such and such words. In which case, he would not be telling us that the book was necessarily from the real Enoch. But the fact that Jude quoted from Enoch as if it was authoritative was one of the things that made the church fathers very reluctant to include Jude in the Bible. It was one of the last books to be accepted in the canon of the New Testament because Jude did quote from that apocryphal book, and also he alluded to another apocryphal book, which we don't have anymore, but the church fathers knew of it. The book was called The Assumption of Moses. And in that book, there was this anecdote about Satan and the archangel Michael contending over the body of Moses. And Jude makes reference to that, too. And that comes from a book that's no longer really available, although the books of Enoch are available still. But the book Assumption of Moses is not. And so the fact that that Jude used these non-canonical books as if they were authoritative is what cast doubts upon whether he should be included in the Bible or not. I'm not sure how they made the decision finally to include him. It strikes me as a possibility that he was simply quoting these as popular literature rather than as inspired literature. And they were popular literature. And, you know, preachers, I think Jude is just a sermon. I don't think Jude is an epistle. I think it's a sermon. And when preachers preach sermons, they often quote from non-inspired sources to make illustrations and things like that. And I think that's what Jude was probably doing.
Huh. Okay. And so in relation to him making reference, you know, again, to these books and stuff like that, I do understand what you're saying in relation to the sermons aspect. Now, I don't know if, like, this is Jude, what Jude was this? Because isn't there one of the apostles that's a Jude, or?
There were actually two apostles named Jude, including Judas Iscariot, which is Jude
mm-hmm.
Iscariot.
Oh, yeah, because there's Judas not Iscariot, you know. That's right.
There's mention of Judas not Iscariot also. But neither of those wrote this book. This book was written by Jude, the brother of James, who wrote the book of James. And both of those men were the half-brothers of Jesus, according to tradition.
Huh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah, I was just kind of thinking about that as far as that, you know, and I'm going to say it this way, that if he included references, you know, in this additional book or whatever, and it's actually, you know, in what we know as, you know, our canon, you know, the Bible and stuff like that, okay, I wasn't sure about that. I didn't know it, and I guess, therefore, it does make it a little more interesting that he chose to quote it, and it is part of, again, our canon now. So, all right. I'd never thought about where those references came from, at least not
yeah.
to, you know, a great degree.
Well,
they don't.
Yeah, they don't come from the Old Testament.
Okay. All right, brother.
All right, brother.
Love you. Take care.
Thanks for your call.
Week.
You too.
Okay.
Bye now. Okay, Jeremiah is next from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Jeremiah.
Hey, Steve.
Welcome.
Thank you. Hey, last week we were talking for a little bit about Reformed theology and the views of salvation, and I mentioned that salvation is like seeing the reality of who God and Christ is, you know, and the beauty of Christ. And you mentioned that you usually don't hear or Reformed people refer to it that way. And earlier on, you were talking about people just being enemies of God and their fist waving the air against God, and then God changes their will. And that contrast. And so we're just starting to get into that before the session ended. But what I want to get at is that I think that they both work together, and they're not like contrary, you know. And I don't know how easy it is to jump back into that discussion that we were having last week.
Well, it would not be too difficult. Let me just take a moment to bring our listeners up to speed, because not everyone will remember that conversation. My friend Jeremiah here is a Calvinist, and I'm not a Calvinist. We talk about those things sometimes, and last time we talked, we were talking about, is that controversial discussion about God making people willing against their will to become Christians. And what I said is that all the Calvinists I know, and this would apparently, Jeremiah would be apparently an exception, but all the Calvinists I have debated, all the Calvinists I've read, all the Calvinists I know have said that until you are regenerated, you hate God. You are an enemy of God. You shake your fist at God. That in your heart, you would love to kill God. In fact, Calvinists usually say that every one of us would have killed Jesus if we had lived back then and had the opportunity to do so. And I don't believe that's true. First of all, I don't believe even all the Jews who saw Jesus back then wanted to kill him. And there's certainly no reason to believe that every human being would want to. But the point I would make is that if that is true, if everyone who's not regenerated hates God and wants nothing to do with him, then if God comes and unilaterally changes their mind, then he has converted them against their will, because they didn't want that. Now, Jeremiah called a week or so ago and was saying, well, there's more to it than just that, because people are won over to God from their hatred to being attracted to him by his merits and his excellencies or whatever. I'm going to let you take it from there, Jeremiah, and pick up.
Yeah, and so I was just saying that the two don't necessarily contradict each other, even though just initially it seems like they might, because we are okay. Yes. Okay. I'm sorry. So that they go hand in hand. And so we truly, once God removes the blinders from our eyes, then we truly see the beauty of Christ and who he is. And it's so, in a way, our hearts are arrested by the love of God, and then we see God as how truly lovely he is. And so, just like earlier on in that same conversation, we're talking about there's different views of the atonement, and they don't necessarily have to be at the exclusion of each other. Both of these analogies of salvation and coming to God don't have to be at the exclusion of each other as well.
Well, Jeremiah, what I'm having trouble with here is that all the Calvinists I've talked to about this have said that it's not a matter of the unbeliever just not seeing how beautiful God is, but that the unbeliever is so evil, and so inclined to evil, that if they could see God's holiness, if they could see God's glory, they would hate it all the more, because it is so contrary to their depraved nature. So, in other words, if that's true, it would seem that it would take far more than God just making himself more visible to them. If anything, the depraved nature of man, according to the Calvinists I've talked to, would make them hate God more the more of his holiness they saw.
Yeah, well, I believe that to be true. I mean, based off, like, with that Romans 8 and First Corinthians 2, I'm sure you've heard those things about the natural man doesn't perceive mm-hmm. the things of God, nor can he. And the carnal mind is that enmity against God. And so there is that sense of a real definite resistance to God and everything that he is. But once it's like we're in captivity and in bondage and enslaved, and we have and that's all that we know. And but we love it because that's all that we know. But when Christ comes and sets us free and liberates us, we see something that we've never seen before. And there's a freedom that we're granted from God, and then we embrace that and we run to that and we cling to that, because Christ does liberate our captive us from captivity of sin.
Well then, that doesn't sound very Calvinistic to me, but if you as a Calvinist can hold that view, that's fine.
Okay, all right. Okay. All right.
Yeah, because I believe the same thing. I believe the same thing. I believe that the main reason most people reject God is because they don't have a clear vision of what he is like. Although there certainly are people who are so depraved and so evil that they would hate God no matter how clear a vision they had of him, because he's so different from them and so different from what they want to be. But see, the Calvinists I've talked to have indicated that all unregenerate people are in this worst category. The Calvinists I've debated have suggested that these people, even when they're in hell, are going to be standing, cursing God and screaming out their hatred for God, even when they're in hell. That's pretty. And James White is the one who used those terms, and he made it sound like everyone who's not a Christian hates God like that. I don't think that's true.
Yeah, I think there may be various degrees of that. Real quickly, then, what is your take on First Corinthians 2 and Romans 8 as far as the
carnal? Well, First Corinthians 2 says the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God because they're spiritually discerned and they're foolishness to him. That is referring to the deep things of God that he's talking about earlier in the chapter. When he wrote to the Corinthians, he said that they, when he had been with them, he had not been capable of teaching them the things that he likes to teach to mature people. In the opening verses of 1 Corinthians 2, he says, "When I was with you, I determined to know nothing among you but Christ and him crucified." But in verse 6, he says, "But to the mature, we go further than that." He says, "To the mature, we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, not human wisdom, which the rulers of this world did not know." But he says that hidden wisdom, that secret wisdom of God, which is the deep things of God revealed by the Spirit. And then he says, now the natural man does not receive these things of the Spirit of God, these deep things of God, because they're spiritually discerned. Now, what he's saying is that the Corinthians, although they were Christians, could not receive these deep things. They were thinking, no, because they were carnal, as he puts it in chapter 3, verse 1. He says, when I wrote to you, I had to speak to you as to carnal and to babes. He says that they were thinking like ordinary men. That is, as carnal Christians, they were thinking the same way that natural men think. And natural men cannot receive these deep things of God. So Paul was not able to teach them, he says, those deep things of God. If you read the whole of chapter 2 and the opening verses of chapter 3, you'll see this is what he's talking about. And therefore, what he's saying is the Corinthians, who were carnal and no better in their thinking than natural men, he says, essentially couldn't receive what he would have liked to have taught them. So he just taught them the gospel because they could receive that. So he's not saying that they couldn't receive the gospel. He's saying they could not receive the deeper things of God, which he mentions beginning at chapter 2, verse 6.
Okay.
And in Romans,
yeah.
Paul said that the fleshly man sets his minds on the things of the flesh, and the spiritual man sets his mind on the things of the Spirit. And that, whoever's got the fleshly mind is at enmity with God and, cannot be subject to the law of God. I'm going from memory here. I don't have it open in front of me. But the point he's making is that a fleshly person generally is set on, his mind is set on fleshly things, just as a spiritual person, his mind is generally on spiritual things. Now, of course, this is not universally always true every moment. Spiritual people sometimes think about unspiritual things. And fleshly people, if the world religions are any indication, sometimes set their mind on spiritual things. But the point is that, in general, a person whose mind is set on the flesh cannot please God. You can't please God while you're setting your mind and your sights and your values on fleshly things. And that's, generally speaking, what unregenerate people do. They're mainly concerned about unspiritual things. But that doesn't mean they never have any moments where they think about other things than that. I think that every person at some point or another has thoughts about God, thoughts about spiritual things, concerns about their soul at one point or another, even if they're natural men. Even if it can be said that they normally set their mind on things of the flesh, people have their vulnerable moments. And of course, that's true of spiritual men. Paul says the reverse about spiritual people. He says, whoever's in the Spirit sets their mind on the things of the Spirit. Okay, well, that's you and me. Are our minds on the things of the Spirit every single day, every moment? I don't think so. But it is, in general, what spiritual people have set their minds on, their concerns on. So, I mean, Paul is not making some universal Calvinist point. He's simply making an observation that worldly people tend to think about worldly things, and spiritual people tend to think about spiritual things. And when your mind is on worldly things, you can't please God. But he's not trying to make a theological point about the depravity of man in general. He's pointing out that while people are thinking about worldly things, they're not going to be able to do the things that please God.
In 1 Corinthians, where it talks about the natural man, how can an unregenerate person be outside the realms of being a natural person and limited to the flesh?
No, an unregenerate person is a natural man.
Yeah, and so if their limitations are what 1 Corinthians says, that they cannot...
They can't receive those things that Paul said are revealed by the Holy Spirit. You're right. But he said those are the deep things of God. If you read 1 Corinthians 2, the whole chapter, not just the last verses, but read the whole chapter, and just notice this. In the first five verses, Paul tells the Corinthians that because of their carnality, of course, he mentions their carnality in chapter 3, verse 1, but because of their carnality, he was not able to go very far with them. Even though he remained 18 months with them, they never got very far. He could only give them milk and not solid food, he said. And therefore, he restricted himself among them to the discussion of Christ and him crucified, which is the basic gospel message. They never got any beyond that. But in verse 6, chapter 2, verse 6, he says, but we do give more than that to mature people, which, of course, the Corinthians were not mature people. But he says, to the mature, we do speak the wisdom of God in a mystery. And then he goes on and talks about that for the rest of the chapter. And in that section, he talks about these are the things that are eye has not seen, ears not heard, it hasn't entered the heart of man, but God has revealed them to us by his Spirit. He says, for the Spirit searches all things, yea, the deep things of God. So what he's calling the things of the Spirit are the things that human minds can't conceive of, and they have to be revealed by the Spirit of God, and they are called the deep things of God. Those are the things the natural man, like the Corinthians, could not receive because they didn't have the capacity. Jesus said something similar to that to his disciples in the upper room in John 16:13. He said, I have many things to say to you, but you're not able yet to bear them. But when the Holy Spirit comes, he will lead you into all truth. So there comes a time when there is a season, at least, in the lives of young Christians where they simply aren't mature enough to receive the things of the Spirit of God. That is, the deep things of God. They can receive the gospel. The gospel is simple. Anyone can receive that. A child can receive that. But the deep things of God are for those who, as it says in Hebrews chapter 5, who are mature and who, by reason of use, have their senses exercised to discern good and evil. I would just say the answer to your question is in the whole chapter 2 and the first few verses of chapter 3. That's the context of the verse you're asking about, and it's pretty clear what Paul's talking about there.
But I think chapter 1 would speak to it as well, because even the basic message of the gospel of Jesus Christ, him crucified, is foolishness and is an offense to
hey, Jeremiah, to
religious people and to Gentiles.
Yeah, I've got to run. I've got my lines full, and I only have a few minutes left.
All right, man.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for your call, Jeremiah. God bless you. Okay, Sarah from Santa Cruz has been waiting a long time. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi. I'm confused about Islam versus Christianity. My understanding is that they both used the Old Testament as their origin, and something like this. Abraham and Sarah get together, can't have a kid, so Abraham and Hagar, his mistress, have a child, Ishmael or something, and then later on Sarah is able to have a child and has Isaac, and then that line goes down to Jesus or Christianity, and then the other line goes to Islam, the mistress, and the other...
To the Arab nations,
yeah. Go on to Muhammad and then Islam. So my question is, why are Christians so certain that they have the truth? Do they have the story that they follow? They took the Old Testament and they say, okay, we all believe the Old Testament. Muhammad says, okay, we all believe the Old Testament. And then the Jews say, well, you got it wrong. You're borrowing from us and you're going in a different direction. And Christianity says, okay, we've got the answer. This is our Jesus was divine. Muhammad wasn't divine. It's really confusing because how are you so sure? And the problem in Israel and Middle East is that people are so sure. They believe they have one God. And this problem of one God, there's so much judgment. I hear so much ethical judgment. It's okay for you to have social judgment, but I hear almost anger and this ethical judgment against other ways of thinking and kind of this hell and God is angry and blah, blah, blah. When I think of Jesus, I think of do not judge, turn the other cheek, love your neighbor, love your enemy as yourself, and these wonderful ways of seeing that we cannot.
Okay. Well, let me start to ask you.
Why are Christians right? And everyone else is
wrong. Well, maybe one of the reasons is...
I'll hang up and listen to the radio because I've already got 25 minutes on my cell phone.
Okay, Sarah. Thanks for your call. Well, the question of whether Islam is right or Christianity is right or Judaism is right has got to be decided on the basis of their truth claims and what evidence there is for their truth claims. I mean, why restrict it to those three religions? You've got Hinduism, you've got Buddhism, you've got Confucianism, you've got Mormonism, you've got all kinds of religions out there. Each one makes different truth claims. And what you need to do is examine the truth claims. Now, what Christianity claims is that Jesus is the Son of God, that he came to earth to die for our sins and to rise again. And that God has now seated him at his right hand and is continuing to build his kingdom through the preaching of the gospel. Now, I don't want you to get confused between what I'm talking about and what you see in institutional Christianity. Unfortunately, after Jesus left, less than a century after Jesus left, his movement began to be, in my opinion, corrupted by certain people who turned it into a more political kind of organization, a political and religious organization. Jesus established a kingdom, and he was the king. And he redeemed his people, and he has offered himself to be the redeemer of all people who will turn to him. And so, actually, Muhammad didn't offer that, and no one in Judaism has offered that. So, for one thing, Christianity makes a claim that no other religion claims, and that is that God has come down to us to redeem us from our sins and to rescue us, and he has established a kingdom under his Son, Jesus Christ. And that's a unique claim. Islam doesn't make any claims like that. Judaism doesn't make any claims like that. Hinduism doesn't make any claims like that. So the question then is, okay, these unique claims that Christianity makes, are they true or not? Well, the easiest one to test would be, of course, and the most important claim is that Jesus rose from the dead. if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then there's nothing particularly unique about him that can be demonstrated. I mean, he didn't teach things that were that radically different than what others before him had taught. It's not his teachings that are so radical. It's what he did. And if he did rise from the dead, well, then Christianity is true. If he didn't, then Christianity is false. And so we need to look at the reasons that Christians believe that Jesus rose from the dead. And if their reasons are good, especially if they're unanswerable, then Christianity has every claim to our confidence. And if Christianity is true, then the other religions that contradict it obviously are not true, at least in the areas where they contradict Christianity. And so the resurrection of Christ is the big issue. Now, what's incontrovertible, I mean, no one really seriously who knows anything about history doubts this, is that Jesus really did die. He really did die on a cross, and he was buried. And within a very short time afterward, his disciples were claiming that he rose from the dead. And that would have been something very easy for his enemies to disprove if they could simply just go and find the body. All they have to do is go to the cave where Jesus was buried, bring the body out and say, look, this man did not rise from the dead. He's decomposing right here. And that would have been the end of Christianity. The fact that that never happened and that Christianity grew and convinced thousands and thousands of people of its truthfulness testifies to at least one thing, and that is that body was not available to be presented. If the enemies of Christianity could have done so, that would have been the end of it right there. So the tomb that Jesus was buried in was apparently empty. But how it came to be empty is what needs to be discussed. Now, the disciples claim that Jesus rose from the dead and walked out. This sounds like an extraordinary claim until you consider the things that Jesus did before he died. He raised other people from the dead. He healed all kinds of sickness. He opened the eyes of blind people. He healed leprosy with a touch. He cast demons out of people with a word. He demonstrated that he was not just your ordinary rank-and-file prophet, such as Judaism had known many of, or which Muhammad would be among in the Islamic faith. Jesus was not just a prophet. He was doing things that only God has the prerogative of doing. He could command the wind and the waves, and they would obey him. He could walk on water. Now, these are things that were witnessed by people who didn't expect to see such things and who were terrified when they saw them. But as a result, they came to believe that he was more than a mere human being. Then, of course, when they claimed that he rose from the dead and that they saw him afterwards, those claims are quite in character with the things Jesus did during his lifetime. Now, Jesus didn't do these things just privately for his disciples. He did these things publicly. The masses followed Jesus around because of his healings and his miracles. And after his resurrection, over 500 people saw him alive again. And these are some of the reasons why, you know, Christianity has some rather interesting evidences that Jesus rose from the dead. There's far more, but I'm afraid my music's playing. I can't get into it all. But that the reason that we follow Christianity instead of Islam or Judaism or Hinduism or some other religion is Christianity alone makes a claim that God has come down to us to save us. And he came down in the person of Jesus, and he proved it, not only by the miracles that Jesus worked, but by his rising from the dead and the miracles he continued to work through his people, the church, after he was gone, because he gave his disciples the power to continue the same kind of things he did. And they did. And that's why Christianity grew from nothing to many, many, many thousands of adherents in the very town where Jesus had been crucified a few weeks earlier. I can't go into it all now. I could do it if we tried earlier in the program sometime. All I can do now is say, The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and if you'd like to help us pay our radio bills, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Tomorrow night we have a monthly meeting in Santa Cruz. Information at the website, thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend. I'll talk to you again Monday if you tune in. God bless.